Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll present a new podcast from the WISO website featuring Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt and his most recent column in Antioch College's online publication, The Independent. We'll hear this week's reinvention story, Bill Felker, and more. Up first, WISO News Director Emily McCord with this week's Politics Ohio.
It's been a big week for advocates of same-sex marriage in the state. First, federal judge Timothy Black issued a ruling that Ohio must recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. And then Attorney General Mike DeWine approved new language for a petition to overturn Ohio's ban on gay marriage. Ian James is with the group Freedom Ohio, who's behind that effort. He says the judge's decision this week adds momentum to legalizing same-sex marriage.
It keeps the conversation alive. I think you just saw U.S. Senator Portman is readdressing the issue of marriage equality. And what the senator is saying is, yes, the court will likely make a decision on this, but in his estimation, voters should make the decision. And he feels, from what I've been reading, that it stands to be more warmly received if the voters decide this than having a judicial fiat say, this is the way it shall be. And, you know, there is a lot of thinking that that is the right way to go. Look at these other very divisive social issues, you know, from abortion to marriage equality. When the court decides these issues, it does, you know, it does boil some blood. When voters decide it boils blood, but you at least have that public conversation and stay. So what we're seeing with the judges' decision is a greater conversation is occurring that brings about greater understanding about what LGBT families face on a daily basis and the inequality that exists with marriage discrimination.
Now, your group has been at odds with some other supporters and advocates of gay marriage who do not want a ballot issue on same-sex marriage. Are you concerned that pushing this would actually hamper the efforts of legalizing gay marriage?
No, not at all, because this has it actually has the effect of creating public support so that when the court does view these issues, it does have an impact on the judicial rulings. Plus, no one knows what the Supreme Court's going to rule. I mean, anybody that tells you that this is exactly how they're going to rule, tell me what the lottery numbers are going to be tomorrow, because you've got a power that no one else has. So the reality here is, you know, if the Supreme Court rules and says, hey, you know what, it's equality for everybody. Everybody's going to be treated equally. Everybody has the right to marry. Then our work on this is done. However, if the Supreme Court says, all those states that have marriage equality, you've got marriage equality. The rest of you have to have some vote of the people. Then you can't have that vote of the people unless you're prepared. And that's what we're doing.
I want to ask you about this focus on marriage. There's a lot of other discrimination that affects gay communities. What's the reason behind that? Why marriage in such a focus?
Well, 2 years ago, Freedom Ohio actually said, you know, we're going to focus on marriage while other organizations focused on bullying, non-discrimination laws, and what have you. And we said, you know what, we support your actions. And we chose to move forward with marriage. Since that time, I think you'll see that the winds really are at the back of marriage equality. But that said, there are still in Ohio some 70% of the Ohio voters really do support equal housing and employment. And I think it's something like 85% or so of Ohio voters actually think that that's already the law. It's not. So, you know, Freedom Ohio is actually, with this new petition on marriage, is also going to circulate a petition for Equal Housing and Employment Act, which is a bill that's been languishing in the legislature for several years. Its time has come. We're going to take it to the voters and allow the voters to have this conversation. So you're right. You know, there's been a focus on marriage, but that doesn't mean there shouldn't be a focus on other important social justice issues, and Freedom Ohio is taking a lead on that as well.
I want wondering if you can put Ohio in sort of a larger context of where Ohio is compared to maybe other states that have legalized same-sex marriage.
Sure. Yeah, the concept of marriage equality, we still have a way to go to convince people, and so it's about equally split right now. But then when it gets into the specifics, do you agree that two people should have the freedom to marry and that religious houses of worship should have the freedom to refuse to perform a marriage? Then you find that 56% of Ohio voters support that. So I think that Ohio is at a tipping point. Ohio is certainly a battleground state. And the reason it is a battleground state is a very purple state. It's not red. It's not blue. It's very much right in the middle. And, you know, as that old saying goes, as goes Ohio, so goes the nation. You know, I think that with Ohio winning marriage equality, you will see other states stand up and say, we want this as well.
That's Ian James with the group Freedom Ohio. You're listening to Politics Ohio on WYSO. I'm Emily McCord.
This week, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base held a series of meetings for small businesses in the defense industry. The event was part of an effort to work more with small contractors. Base officials say it helps them stay efficient as government cuts defense budgets. Those cuts have been bad news for local industry, which provides the Air Force with everything from computer systems to airplane parts. But as WYSO's Lewis Wallace reported, not all contractors were feeling the same pain.
Inside a shiny office building across from Wright-Patt, a crowd gathers around a cake with a Predator drone painted onto the frosting. It's an opening event for the General Atomics office. This is a giant company that makes the Predator and Reaper drones out in the Mojave Desert in California. Right now, they only have two employees here in Beaver Creek, but State Rep Rick Perales has high hopes for 5 years from now.
And you'll have, what, 60, 80, 100 people here by then, and both you two will be retired with a lot of money. And
lots of people have been stressed about downsizing lately, but you wouldn't guess it at this party. Frank Pace is head of aircraft systems for General Atomics.
I think unmanned aircraft are here to stay. They're kind of the wave of the future. So I think there's going to be money available to do some things, maybe not as much in the past years, but I think there's going to be development money to do the crucial things.
General Atomics has won more than $8 billion in government contracts for drones just in the last 5 years. But something important happened during those 5 years. The war in Iraq ended, and troops have started coming back from Afghanistan. So imagine that the defense budget was like a plane, going up and up and up, and then in 2010, it starts to dip. Todd Harrison with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment says while the total U.S. defense budget has gone down by 20%, it still hasn't caught up with past drawdowns.
At the end of Vietnam, we saw a decline of about 25%. And of course, at the end of the Korean War, we saw a decline of almost half.
And those recent across-the-board cuts known as sequestration are really more like caps on defense spending.
Those spending caps actually just keep the budget basically flat where it is today.
In other words, the defense budget isn't really in a nosedive. It's leveling out, still high in the sky. The big contractors have slimmed down, but they aren't going anywhere. These wars were bonanzas for them. At the same time, small Miami Valley companies are still trying to figure out how to get into the industry. Lieutenant General C.D. Moore is a commander at Wright-Patt in charge of buying equipment for the Air Force. He says they're trying to do a better job working with small businesses.
Small businesses have been most critical of us because of our inability to accurately forecast opportunities.
And that's what this dialogue with industry is about this week, to let small businesses in on the government's plans for the future.
Frankly, I would tell you that the federal government and the United States Air Force is not always the easiest entity to work with.
You can see the differences for small companies in Chuck Evanhoe's case. He owns an IT company near the Air Force Museum, but it's not in those big offices at the edge of the base. It's in a little gray house across the road.
Hi, Chuck. Uh-huh.
They make barcode systems here, nothing flashy, and Evanhoe's an understated, systematic-seeming guy. He says first they were hit by the recession, and the government became their main customer. But then last year, they saw one government contract cut after sequestration.
They just didn't have the funds available. And so that caused us to lay off a couple of people.
Now he says they're doing fine, or as fine as possible these days.
You just don't know. You don't know if the, you know, where the money's going to come from, where it's going to be cut.
But Chuck Evanhoe says he gets that. The government only has so much money, just like most of us. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
This week on Reinvention Stories, we meet Jerry Bowling, a lifelong resident of Dayton's McCookfield neighborhood, the area around North Dixie Drive. Bowling is active in his community as the president of the Neighborhood Association and leader of a local environmental advocacy group. But while working to reinvent his neighborhood, Bowling has also had to reinvent himself. Sarah Buckingham has this week's story.
Jerry Bowling had worked at Delphi for 15 years when the economic crisis hit the automotive industry. First came pay cuts, and then...
They had a meeting in the cafetorium to make the announcement that they were going to close operations in Vandalia. People were pretty much stunned by that. And on December 18th, 2009, was the last day at Delphi.
After being laid off, Bowling was eligible for something called Trade Adjustment Assistance, or TAA. It's a federal program that would pay for him to get training in a new field. Bowling never did finish college, but even with tuition paid for, he didn't see how he could go to school full-time and still earn enough money to live on.
You know, I still had a lot of bills, credit card bills. I was almost done paying off my truck, but I had to make changes, obviously. You know, in some cases, it was little stuff, like I discontinued getting the newspaper. I changed my cable package down to the bare minimum. You have to change the way you eat. Going out with friends and doing things, less of an option.
Bowling got some financial help from his mom and his siblings while he struggled to make ends meet with the income from two part-time jobs. And he kept looking for that one full-time job that would put him over the top.
And then I got a call from someone at the job center, and they said, "Hey, Jerry, did you know that you're still eligible for the TAA?" And I said, "Really? I didn't know that."
The funding window was closing on that federal program. This was Bowling's last chance.
When I went back to school, I was 53.
He enrolled in an operations technology program at Sinclair. That first semester, he signed up for six classes rather than the normal four, on top of his two part-time jobs.
And it was the holiday season, and I was working retail. So often I went to work and worked till 12:30 at night, and then had classes the next morning. So it was very difficult in getting the work done.
Anybody would struggle to get through school with two jobs, but that's not all Bowling was doing.
I was also president of my neighborhood association, McCookfield Neighborhood Association. Also the leader of Be Vocal, which is an advocate group for the Superfund site in my neighborhood. I was vice chairperson of the Human Relations Council for the city of Dayton.
And during his last semester, he picked up a third job.
There was a few times when I was working on homework or a project, and I would be up at about 3 o'clock in the morning and say, how can I continue to do this? But yet, I'm struggling financially. If I quit, where am I going to be at? I'm not going to be anywhere, so I have to do this.
And he did do it. Bowling earned an associate's degree in August 2013. Right around graduation time, he went to a career fair at Sinclair.
And out of that career fair, I got two job interviews, actually face-to-face job interviews for quality jobs. Whereas before, when I had no education, college education on my resume, it was like zero interviews.
While Bowling's more hopeful about the future after earning a degree, he still hasn't found financial stability.
To this day, even working three jobs, I barely make ends meet. I mean barely, and I still receive some support from my family on a monthly basis. Not much, but some to get by. I'm in the same boat as a lot of people from the automotive industry and industry in general that at an older age, have to start a second career, and I'm lucky that my education was paid for. I'm blessed to have that, but I've got a challenge ahead of me, being I'm about to become 55, and you know, probably I'll have to work until I'm 70 years old. I want to find something that sticks.
Bowling also wants to pay back the family and friends that have supported him through this rough time.
When I was younger and we used to go up to the Ponderosa here in the neighborhood, my dad would stand at the end of the line. And when you stood at the end of the line, you were the one that would pay for the meal. So it's my hope after I get employment that I'll stand at the end of the line and pay for the meals.
For WISO, I'm Sarah Buckingham.
Sarah produced this story with Eric Risher. To find out more about Jerry Bowling's community activism and the Superfund site in McCook Field, watch their video at WYSO.org. Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with support from Wright State University Celia Fund, the Yellow Springs Community Foundation, and Antioch College. This is WISO Weekend.
I wanna meet you in the big sky country, like hallelujah in the big sky country, just like forever and ever is wild. Beginning over in the big sky country, be kissing time, kissing time.
Ever since the Wright brothers began selling airplanes, there's always been a mystique about the airplane owner. Not everyone can or will buy one. Paul Glenshaw tells us that 70 years ago, one man tried to make buying an airplane as easy as buying a shirt.
His name was Oliver Parks. His sales career began with chocolate bars and moved up to Chevrolets. After a close call as a young pilot in the late 1920s, he opened the Parks Air College, a flight school in East St. Louis. The college expanded during World War II, teaching thousands of GIs to fly. They would be coming home someday, and Parks assumed they'd want to keep flying. He sensed a huge market opening up. At a 1944 meeting in Riverdale, Maryland, he pitched a bold scheme to the Engineering and Research Company, or ERCO. ERCO had just what Parks needed, an airplane that could be marketed as safe and easy as driving a car. It was the Ercoupe, a low-wing monoplane with two seats. The controls were simple, a steering wheel and no rudder pedals. It had wheels like a tricycle and could be driven on the ground just like a car. And best of all, it had been certified as incapable of spinning, a dangerous kind of stall, especially for inexperienced pilots. Parks knew airplane manufacturers were going to compete for customers with refrigerator and car makers. He was convinced that the key to success was to sell airplanes in familiar surroundings, not in small airports where light airplanes were typically sold, but in department stores. Parks knew the returning GIs and their families would buy almost everything else there. Parks set up distribution and regional managers and signed up the stores. Marshall Fields in Chicago was first. Famous Bar in St. Louis and others followed. ERCO, the airplane's manufacturer, made other deals with stores directly, including Macy's and JCPenney's. Piper Aircraft, a competitor, set up sales with Wanamaker's. By the fall of 1945, there were airplanes nestled in sales floors among the blenders and overcoats all over the country. Once hooked, a customer made a deposit on the plane at the store, and then took delivery and instruction at a nearby airport. Initial sales were brisk. Aircoupe production grew from one part-time shift to three full-time shifts, going 24 hours a day. There were full-page ads in the New York Times. A post-war dream of an airplane in every garage seemed to be coming true. And then it was over. Parks was almost correct in his predictions. The post-war consumer did want fridges and cars, but airplanes, not as much. The manufacturers were soon drowning in unsold inventory. ERCO sold the Ercoupe off. Just over 5,000 were ultimately built by a variety of manufacturers through the 1970s. Parks was right about the product, though. Over 2,000 of them are still flying. He gave his beloved Air College to St. Louis University and went into prefabricated housing. For WYSO, this is Paul Glenshaw.
Paul Glenshaw is a writer living in Tacoma Park, Maryland. To see an article he wrote about the department store airplane, go to our website, wyso.org. Aviation programming on WYSO is supported in part by the National Aviation Heritage Alliance and the Air Force Museum Foundation. Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt writes a monthly column for the online publication The Independent. WYSO will now offer that column as a new podcast. Here's Roosevelt with this week's essay.
There are some things you have to look away from if you're going to make it through the day and stay sane. For me, the human population explosion and the extinction crisis among other species is such a topic, although I've not stopped reading about it. I recently finished Stephen Meyer's The End of the Wild and Elizabeth Colbert's The Sixth Extinction, but I'm not ready to write about it. Just because there are things I have to run away from does not mean I want to avoid reality entirely, just that part of reality that seems at the moment too difficult to bear. For comfort, I don't choose to turn to cheery music or stories. Attempts at glossing things over exacerbate rather than relieve a sour mood. Instead, I find that certain kinds of dark books make me feel better, perhaps because they acknowledge life's myriad challenges, or perhaps because they remind me how much worse things can get. Of course, what kind of dark books hit home has a great deal to do with your life experience and your way of looking at the world. I'm attracted to stories, often crime novels, in which the main character exhibits a well-earned world weariness, but still struggles to make a difference. For that reason, and because of the magical quality of his writing, Raymond Chandler is one of my favorite writers. He didn't write that much, 24 short stories and 7 novels. His later novels, especially The Long Goodbye, his masterpiece, are wonderful, pain-filled searches for things to hold on to, love or friendship. His protagonist, Philip Marlowe, is a loner who somehow maintains a certain wistful idealism. His life experience screams, "Give up," but he can't. In The Long Goodbye, Marlowe says, "I hear voices crying in the night, and I go see what's the matter." In his essay, The Simple Art of Murder, Chandler writes that his protagonist is in search of redemption in a savage world. In his fictional world, Chandler writes, down these mean streets, a man must go who is not himself mean, who is neither tarnished nor afraid. The detective in this kind of story must be a complete man, and a common man, and yet an unusual man. He must be, to use a rather weathered phrase, a man of honor. By instinct, by inevitability, without thought of it, and certainly without saying it. He is a lonely man. He has a range of awareness that startles you, but it belongs to him by right, because it belongs to the world he lives in. If there were enough like him, the world would be a very safe place to live in without becoming too dull to be worth living in. Of course, this sense of obligation to respond to nighttime cries is a pretty heavy burden. And late in his career, his own life in shambles, Chandler seemed willing to let Marlowe cast it aside. In a draft of the last novel, Playback, Marlowe says, "Give up? Sure I give up. I'm in the wrong business. I ought to have given up before I started. The hell with it." But Chandler eliminated the passage in the final version. And now, Marlowe battles on one more time as the Irish novelist John Banville, writing as Benjamin Black, has just published a new Marlowe novel, The Black-Eyed Blonde. Banville gets the essential aspects of Marlowe and his world just right. His Marlowe knows that he is a pushover, and he understands what that portends. He says, "I thought there wasn't much more damage that could be done to me that hadn't already been done. You get hardened by life knocking away at you since you were old enough to feel heart sore, but then comes a knock that's bigger than anything you've experienced so far, and you realize just how soft you are, just how soft you'll always be." Chandler's own life was pretty dreary. Before becoming a writer, he worked in the oil business, but he drank too much and was fired. Socially awkward and dominated by his mother, Chandler waited for her death to marry Sissy Pascal, a twice-divorced woman 18 years his senior. They had no children, were easily bored, and to avoid staring at the same walls and views for too long, moved incessantly. They lived in over 30 apartments and houses in their 30 years together. After Sissy's death, Chandler, bereft, drank himself to death in 5 years' time. But his dreary life did not keep him from writing magical prose. Interviewed in the December 15, 2013 New York Times Book Review, crime novelist Michael Connelly said that he would, quote, like to ask Raymond Chandler about chapter 13 of The Little Sister. It describes a drive around 1940s Los Angeles, and it still holds up as a description of the city right now. Beautiful. I'd ask him how he pulled that off, and I'd tell him that that short chapter of his was what made me want to become a writer. I'd also ask him whether it takes a tortured life to produce something like that. I'd say, Ray, can a writer be happy and still be good at it? I don't know the answer to that, but perhaps fathoming how difficult it is to craft a decent life in a world that seems even madder today than it was in Chandler's day will help us better understand why we cannot get our act together to stop destroying the planet we live on. And we should also appreciate the art that Chandler made from his struggles. As A.O. Scott wrote in a recent film review in the New York Times, quote, we are, as a species, ridiculous, vain, ugly, selfish, and self-deluding. But somehow, some of our attempts to take stock of this condition, our songs and stories and moving pictures, old and new, manage to be beautiful, even sublime. I'm Mark Roosevelt, president of Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. For more information about our liberal arts curriculum, where students discover not only good books to read, but also new and better ways of living in the world, go to antiochcollege.org. Thanks.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of Middle Spring. The first seasons of the year are already gone now. Bloodroot season and violet crest season. Twin leaf season, snowdrop season, snow trillium seasons, and so many more seasons. I've only watched a few of them, and I am wondering about what I've missed. They are fragments of a story, the meaning of which has always set me wondering. I wonder about the meaning of the seasons of the landscape, because I'm wondering about my own seasons and what they mean. I watch them and I am in suspense because I don't know exactly how they will turn out. Each year, spring always overpowers winter, finds fulfillment in the summer, teaches all the lessons of the beauty and the power of procreation and decay, is sealed in the tomb of December, only to rise again triumphant in April. I watch the story every time as if it might be my own story, but I'm never quite sure that it is mine. Or I don't know why it is or how. And then when the year's plot unfolds all the way, that's never quite enough for me, and so I start over. What did I miss last year and the year before? Why am I still in suspense? Why can't I believe? I read the book again. What will it say this time? This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the final week of Middle Spring. In the meantime, watch your story carefully. See if you know how it ends. Thursday noons, between March 20th and April 24th, I will be the moderator of a seminar at the University of Dayton entitled The Inner Landscape. And these will be discussions about the almanac readings on WISO. For more information, call the Special Programs Office at the University of Dayton, 937-229-2605.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WISO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WISO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio. Up next, the Book Nook.